Mr. Chair, are we going to go in order?
The Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Before I go to Madam Vice Chair, I just want to point out that we're waiting for some documentation and other material, so the work sessions on SB 125 and 133 will be carried over till next week. And with that, I'm going to go to Madam Vice Chair, and then we're going to skip around just a little bit. The first bill we will be hearing is HB 2633, and we'll actually open a work session on that and close it so that we can accommodate the schedules of some of our members who have other duties. But first, Madam Vice Chair.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For those sitting out there in the audience, I like to always open the Veterans Committee with portraits of women combat veterans. There are a lot of issues coming up with women in the military, and I like sharing some of the thoughts that some of the women have. And this happens to come from Sergeant Catherine Broom, and she's in the Virginia Army National Guard. "You get mortared so much, and then you find out it's the guys just down the street who are selling you rugs to mail home to your family, or the guys in the kitchen who are washing the dishes. My roommate was really upset when I first came home because I was throwing around the H word. Haji did this and Haji did that. I didn't used to be a racist. I was liberal. I was open-minded. When I came home for the first few months, I kept a switchblade in my purse that I called my Haji sticker. My roommate and a best friend both talked to me one night, and they were like, 'You didn't used to be this way.' The fact that the government has instilled a hatred inside of you towards an entire percentage of the population is really disturbing. After they talked to me about it, I didn't say the H word anymore. I try to not have bad thoughts about people and to not judge them on their outward appearances." Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Good words of wisdom there. With that, colleagues, we're going to go ahead and move on. The first bill we're going to hear is HB 2633, and I will ask a good representative to come forward while counsel is teeing us up for 2633.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
For questions, general counsel up here, or
your choice.
Counsel and Mr. Mann from the Veterans Department.
We're your disposable over here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2633. Authorizes the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to define honorable conditions via rule. It declares an emergency is effective on passage. The House committee vote was 7-0, and the House floor vote was 56 with 4 excused.
Madam Representative.
Thank you very much, Chair Boquist, members of the Senate Veterans Committee. I'm here today to present a simple housekeeping bill. It's a bill that defines the term honorable conditions for statutory purposes. Specifically, it has the Department of Veterans Affairs define the term under rule in order to clear up some legal ambiguity about the term's meaning, while allowing the department to clarify the term as they use it in deciding benefits. I'll be a little more of the more complicated aspects I will leave to legislative counsel, who helped us develop the bill and can speak to the technical questions at hand. A little bit of background. I think you've had some conversations with one of my constituents who called and said there seems to be ambiguity between the federal definition and the state definition of honorable discharge and honorable conditions. And so when we brought it to the Military Department and General Counsel, Legislative Counsel, worked together to come up with this bill, which defines it. After some research, Ms. Sidlick of Legislative Counsel said there was indeed some legal ambiguity. So we began to work together with the Department of Veterans Affairs in order to solve this. We wanted to solve the ambiguity in a way that best allowed the department to continue to use the term as they had previously. After several conversations with the Veterans Department, we reached the bill that you have in front of you, which simply defines the term in statute to what the Veterans Department defines it in their rules. This clears up the legal ambiguity and solves the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Mann.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Mann with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Representative Dougherty brought this bill to us in the interim. The original bill would have had us put it in statute, which we thought was a little extreme. We agreed that it would be best in rule. As you know, federal definition of what a veteran is for VA, U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, veteran benefits may be a little bit different for how we in the state define veteran under ROS 408-225 for state benefits. The department's never really had an issue defining what type of discharge is what for the benefits, because that's kind of our expertise and our lane in the road. However, to help clarify any kind of concern people might have, we were more than willing to stick it in rule and help clarify any ambiguity that might be out there.
So, Mr. Mann, I do have a question. So are all these emails that you and I are exchanging going to stop because this is the same constituent or the representative?
Mr. Chair, I do hope so.
Yes.
I was just checking. Council, anything to add?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'm Melissa Seidlick, Deputy Legislative Counsel, and I drafted the bill before you. Besides what has already been stated, let me just go a little bit more into detail about why our office thought this bill was needed. As you know, part of our responsibility is to alert the legislature when our laws might be misconstrued or misinterpreted, and this seemed to be one of those instances. Under Oregon law, the definition of veteran includes a service member who is discharged or released under honorable conditions. And the problem arises in that there are many different kinds of discharges, and two in particular cause the confusion here. The first is the honorable discharge, which is the kind of discharge a service member gets when they achieve the highest rating of good to excellent. And then there is the general discharge under honorable conditions, which is a lesser rating. It's a satisfactory rating, but with some concerns over performance. And the concern of our office was that having under honorable conditions in the statutes would be interpreted by, for example, a constituent or a state agency or even a court as meaning just the general discharge under honorable conditions and not the honorable discharge. So this bill clarifies, this bill together with the legislative history being developed here this session, clarifies that however the rules are adopted by the department, they will include, under honorable conditions, will include both kinds of discharges, honorable discharge and the under honorable conditions. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, questions? Senator Courtney, questions? Senator Olson, questions? And so my emails will stop, right? Okay.
Chair Boquist, and I didn't identify myself for the record. I'm Representative Margaret Doherty from House District 35. I did talk to the constituent this morning, and I said, you know, it has been cleared up from a legal standpoint and also through the Department of Veterans Affairs. And between those are the ones that they make the difference because they are the ones that make the decisions.
Well, so. We do appreciate you bringing this forward, House Bill 2633, and I didn't look at the I'm assuming it came out 60-0 on the other chamber.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Parrish, are you here on House Bill 2633? So you're not. So I'm going to jump around here in a minute. Okay. Colleagues, since I don't see much discussion here, what we'll do is we'll be closing the public hearing on House Bill 2633 and instructing council to schedule it for a work session next week.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative. And with that, we're closing the public hearing on 2633. And
Did she want to proceed without Representative Bailey?
Do you want to proceed without Representative Bailey, or you want to wait for him? Then, Madam Representative, you can wait. Which is a short one here. HCR 9. Let's go back to the top list.
Neither of those representatives are here.
Do we have all kinds of guests today?
We have all kinds of guests today, Mr. Chair.
What's on SB 34?
That's an ODBA, though. So
okay. We're going to open a public hearing on SB 34. And again, I apologize for jumping around, but we do have guests from the other chamber coming over on other bills, and I do want to accommodate their schedule. So SB 34 is the next one in line. And with that, if you'd be kind enough, Madam Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 34 removes the limit on the number of home or farm loans received or assumed from Department of Veterans Affairs, declares emergency effective on passage.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Tom Mann with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. With me is Steve Schlag, our loan manager. This is a really simple bill. Currently in statute, you may have two Oregon Department of Veterans home loans, unless, of course, there is some kind of hardship like your company moves you. But it's an arbitrary rule that's been in statute, I think, since 1945. They figured that 1945, how many homes do you really need? Probably two in your lifetime. Well, we know that life is a little bit more transient nowadays. You could have a 30-year-old veteran that buys his first home with us, and at 45, they want to expand because they have children. And then at 65, they may want to downsize. But they're only allowed two loans under the current statute. What this bill does, Senate Bill 34, it simply eliminates the number. You can have as many loans through the department as you can finance. Of course, our underwriting standards won't change, and you still have to qualify, and you have to pay off your previous loan and all those great things you have to do. But this would just take away the arbitrary ceiling and limit on the number of loans you can get through our department.
Vice Chair, questions? Senator Cornyn.
I'll wait till the other individual testify. Now I have a question.
Steve, you want to add anything to that?
Repeat that once more time. One more time, please, Senator.
I don't believe Senator Cornyn. He's only here for support.
All right. I'm not sure you're right.
Okay.
When I first came here as a freshman, the Veterans Home Loan Program, we were in a very difficult situation. Very difficult. There were unlimited loans. There was no limit. No limit. And it was a very embarrassing situation. And so I think, at least in the early days, where the two, we came in with the limit on two. So all I'm going to say is I'm very sensitive and sympathetic, but I would like the state treasurer to get involved in this before we go down this road, because it was a very, very bad situation back then. I mean that. And so we're the ones that created the two loans limit, the early 80s legislature. So I don't, because before then it was what you said. After the Second World War, it was unlimited on the loans. So I just think, Mr. Chair, you may be planning it, I'd like to have a little more information on this and the history of this, because while it's a very good idea, I think we have to be a little careful about it. That's all I'm going to say at this stage of the game.
Senator Olson?
Yes, I have some questions. Mr. Mann, when you say that, as the good president said, that it would be unlimited, I just qualified for an ODVA loan. Didn't know that I could. And I got my loan qualification is $417,000. So are you stating that every time they come in for a loan that they've paid off another one, you get 417, or is that 417 nibbled into so eventually you only get a $2,000 loan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's a great question. The department for decades has been under the assumption and using the rule that it's an aggregate 417, meaning that you buy your first loan for $200,000, you have $217,000 left of loan right. We were asked by Representative Esquivel and the House Committee to review that, and we looked at the statutes, and we looked with DOJ and asked them to look at the statutes, and we asked our bond counsel if that was actually true. And everyone came back and said, no, that's not actually what the law says. You can have up to $417,000 on each loan. So our department is in the process of looking at our administrative rules to determine what we have in rule, how long it's been there, and if we need to change that based upon what the law actually says, because we have been saying it's an aggregate, but in fact the law states that it can be $417,000 for each loan.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would like to know how many loans do we have out there, and are there default loans? I mean, out of all of those, are there many of our veterans default?
Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Senator Anderson, you're talking about the
Please
current number of loans
we
have outstanding? For the record, my name is Steve Schlag. I am the loan program manager for the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs, ex-banker, now veteran advocate. Currently, we have just over 2,000 loans on the books. We have unfortunately experienced a tremendous runoff over the last 3 years because of other issues that we're trying to combat at this point. Yes, we have defaults. Fortunately for us, defaults are at an extreme low percentage compared to all the other types of loans that exist in the nation. Comparatively to conventional, federal VA and FHA, we are substantially lower in defaults and in delinquencies. If just so happens, not knowing that that question was going to be asked, as I was here yesterday, currently we have less than 1.5% of 90-day and greater delinquencies, including foreclosures. This same year in 2012, and encompassing into the last 2 months of 2013, the default rates for 90% and greater and foreclosure inventories in federal VA lending has been 5.89%. So again, we are substantially less than some of those numbers.
Mr. Chair and Committee, I'd like to talk about the 80s, where the company was underwater. They actually were buying the money at a higher interest rate than they were loaning it out, which is a disaster. I wasn't there then. I can't tell you why. However, we have since tightened up the rules and internally done things where you cannot do that. You simply cannot purchase money at a higher interest rate than you're loaning it out. During this economic collapse, that's one of the reasons the loan program has seen runoff. We can't do refinancing under the law. And to be competitive for us in our market, our interest rates have to be lower than the general marketplace. When the market crashed and interest rates plummeted, we no longer were the lowest interest rate in the state. We were pretty much on par and sometimes even higher, because at the rate we were buying our money, even though they were tax-free bonds, it was higher than what others would be able to loan their money out at. So in 1 year, I think we did 10 loans during the crash because we just were not competitive. The key to our program being successful is that interest rate has to remain lower than the market. And we're very sensitive to the issue you bring up because we have a long memory as well, and that was an absolute almost crashed our agency, and I know that it was the biggest debt for the entire state was our loan program. Back in that day, we had 114,000 loans on the books. Today, we have just a little over 2,000. So it's a little bit different circumstances we're dealing with today.
Yes, question. Sir, this is embarrassing, but let me just ask, because I'm having this terrifying flashback. It's all coming to me. And don't take this wrong. The idea that I just did the Veterans Home Program came out of the Second World War to really allow that guy, he's come back, he's been there for years, a woman, fighting, to get a chance to get a home for himself and his little family. Right. And so it was unlimited. And it was very much the American way to show support for these people who saved our freedom and our country. As I understood it back then, and maybe it's still true here, and you'd support it, but an individual could not only finance their home, they could go and get a second home, a vacation home, and those kinds of homes. Is that also your intent here, that an individual, we'll make our policies, and I defer to you, Senator Olson, Senator Boquist, Senator Ramos Anderson on this, because I think, as sympathetic as I may be, you've already said, it was a situation the state could have gone under. You check it out, could have gone under in this program. As I recall, it was terrifying. Now, we were hearing that from both Democrats and Republicans. We were in a very dangerous financial situation because of this program. So all I'm asking these questions for is, to make sure that you individuals who want this and all the certified smart people are designing this way that doesn't happen again. That's all I'm asking. So, but I am curious about the second or third homes. Should they want them?
Chair Boquist and Senator Courtney, I will share with you that this program is for owner-occupied single-family residents. It must be the primary residence of the veteran applicant. There is no room in the program for income-producing properties or vacation homes. This is the primary residence, and that's what it's designed to be, and that's the way that I run the program.
Thank you.
Follow-up question? Other questions? If, Mr. Mann, if you'd be kind enough to contact counsel and set up an appointment with me, and then I would like to follow up with my comrades in the Treasury office to make sure what their thoughts are on this process, and then we'll come back to this issue before the Senate term of the Senate bills are out. I appreciate that, and there is no one else at this point signed up for SB 34. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 34, and I'm going to open a public hearing on HCR 3. Madam Counsel, if you'll tee us up, and good representatives, if you'll come up, I will try and get you in front here.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, HCR 3 acknowledges Korean veterans for their service during the Vietnam War.
Mr. Chair, would it be okay to introduce Mr. Kim to join us as well? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42, and it's my honor and privilege to bring before you, with good Representative Parrish, HCR 3, which honors Korean veterans for their service in the Vietnam War. This issue came to my attention through a constituent and friend who first made me aware of the service that these men gave for their country and for the challenges that they are now facing. As you can see in the resolution before you, over 325,000 Korean soldiers served in the Vietnam conflict alongside American soldiers. And of them, over 5,000 of them were killed in action. Many of them were wounded, and many of them came home with the same kinds of afflictions that afflict all of the American soldiers, many of the American soldiers that serve there as well. Challenges with getting health care, with getting access to mental health services for PTSD, challenges with Agent Orange. And yet these gentlemen can fall into the cracks in the system, because at the time of their service, they were Korean soldiers. 95% of those that live in the United States now are now American citizens, and fought bravely alongside their American brothers, and yet cannot get access to the same kinds of health care that they need that our returning veterans are able to access. So this resolution simply honors them for their service and their sacrifice for the United States of America in this conflict. We hope that we'll be able to bring you another bill to this committee that will do more to give them access to the kinds of services that they need. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you. Chair Boquist, committee, for the record, I'm Julie Parrish from House District 37, and really appreciative that Representative Bailey brought this forward, and we are offering a companion bill to this as well. But this is one of those bills where we're asking Congress to do what, frankly, it should have done 40 years ago. We should have had a plan in place for people who served in Vietnam and made sure that that plan was executed. And what we've seen over the years is that plan, even for citizens who American citizens who we sent over there, and not folks in this unique category, so even for our homegrown soldiers, we haven't done everything we need to do for soldiers of that era. And like Representative Bailey said, you know, regardless of what who owned you as a whether you're American, Korean, or even a Vietnamese, fighting for America in that conflict, the problems that are associated with Vietnam don't pick your citizenship. So you've got soldiers in this class. I'll step back. The gentleman who you see here sitting with us here today served in our country. They were Korean as citizens at the time. There was an intergovernmental agreement that Korea would South Korean, that America would support those soldiers for injuries incurred on the battlefield. And we know that those injuries have still continued to manifest 40 years later. They're now American citizens. There's about 2,500 of these folks nationwide. We originally thought that the class in Oregon was about 45. We now know that it's less than 20. And so the companion bill is that we're going to try to find a way to solve this at home for our Oregon veterans who meet this criteria. But this is one of those ones where we're just asking to urge Congress. And I think that I will turn it over to our guest, who can certainly articulate his story better than I can.
Sir?
It is really honored. And first of all, I'd like to express my millions of thanks to Korean.
Could you
Korea
say your name,
War
sir?
Veteran.
For the record?
Your name.
So we know who you are.
My name is Young Kim.
Thank you,
I'm
sir.
Representing Northwest Korean Vietnam Association. I'd like to express myself thanks to the million to Korea war veterans who live in Oregon. They fight under the cold weather and last the hot summer. They dedicate a lot of things. And in Korea now, the prosperity is resulted by the dedication of the Korea war veteran who live in Oregon. And we all appreciate it and thanks to the Korea war veteran. Right after Vietnam War, we came to America looking for a better life. And we worked hard. And then suddenly all the physically, mentally deteriorated and suffered. But we don't know where to go. And we tried to be join the VA and try to be recognized. But it's been 30, 40 years without recognitions, and we're still working on it. And we have 5-10 years to go. And I would like to have the honors to be to join the VA and get those honor. Representative Mr. Bailey and Representative Ms. Parrish, they express the whole explanation is right. It all our suffer. He told you everything what we suffering. We only want the recognized by the state, by the federal, as a veteran. And we are here to serve the country, serve the people, not use the country, not use the people for our own sake. Please do help us to recognize us to U.S. veteran. Thank you.
I'd like to add, if that's okay, again, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37. You know, our World War II vets are dying at a pretty quick clip right now. Looking in the paper for the last few weeks, a couple weeks ago we had 13 World War II vets die. We had 8 the week before. We had about 7 or 8 this weekend again. So you're starting to see in that generation a quick, rapidly demising generation of those folks who served. The interesting thing, though, is that you have about as many who are Vietnam vets, and they are dying at the same clip as our World War II veterans are, mainly because of the issues associated with some of the health-related issues from their service. And so so we're asking. We think that it's time. We'd certainly like Congress to solve this problem, but we're also, like I said, going to offer a companion bill where we try to solve the problem here locally. But we'd urge your support for this bill today, and it was passed unanimously off of the House floor, and would hope that it would pass the same off the Senate floor. So thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your service. Madam Vice Chair, question?
I got it.
Thank you for your service to the Koreans who I see the hat, Vietnam veteran. Thank you very much for your service, and welcome home.
Thank you.
Again, we thank you for your service, and what we're going to do is bring up the last panel. Yeah,
Mr. Chair.
Do you have a chair question?
Yes, well, I actually don't have a question. I'd like to thank you for your service. I was in your country in 1970 and 71. You guys had a tremendous reputation as warriors. It is amazing to have you folks sit in front of me now because of the fact that when I was there, we talked so much about you guys going from Korea to Vietnam to fight and what an honorable job you did, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. And we're going to change panels. If you would excuse and ask Mr. Ho Young, Mung Tok Young, and Young Kim to come up. I believe you're signed up.
Please sign up.
Yes. You just signed up?
I just signed up.
You don't want to testify?
Yes. Not speak very well.
Actually, you speak perfectly fine. Speak perfectly fine. We appreciate you
thank
coming.
Thank you very much.
And
thank you.
And for the thank you. And I would just colleagues and for the members of the public that don't know American history, which is generally a lot of people out there, is that the Americans had the Koreans as allies on the ground war in Vietnam, as we had the New Zealanders with us, and the Australians too. And people seem to forget that there were other countries that were involved in that conflict, and it just wasn't an American issue on the ground in Southeast Asia.
Don't forget the Brits.
And the Brits. And of course, the French had been there for a while too. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 3, and we'll move this forward to a work session for next week. And with that, I am going to open a work session on SCR 9. And I would ask, I believe that Senator Haas and Representative Reed, if you...
Public hearing.
Public hearings. Excuse me, I stand corrected. Public hearing. And Council, if you'll tee us up while they're coming up, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 9 memorializes Andrew Keller.
You can argue about who goes first, who's senior, who's junior.
Hello, committee. Mark Haas, State Senate District 14, which is mostly the Beaverton area. Army private, first class, Andrew Keller was a son, a brother, a best friend, and a fiancé. He graduated from Southridge High School in Beaverton in 2008. He was captain and MVP of the football team in that year when Southridge won the Class 6A State High School Football Championship. He joined the Army March 15, 2011, and soon after graduated at the top of his class from Airborne School. In July, he was deployed in Operation Enduring Freedom, and showing exemplary initiative and leadership, he was promoted to team leader within just a few weeks. On the 32nd day after his deployment, August 15, 2012, he was shot and killed by insurgents in Afghanistan during what was supposed to be a 48-hour mission to secure an observation post. We had 800 friends, family, members of the military, and members of the public filled all the seats in the Sunset Presbyterian Church for his funeral, where he was laid to rest at Willamette, and laid to rest at Willamette National Cemetery. He was awarded posthumously a Bronze Star Medal, Purple Heart, and an Army Commendation Medal for exceptional service and wounds received in action. He'll be remembered as a loyal and conscientious young man who cared deeply, deeply for his community, and he left a very positive mark in that community. He's survived by his father, Jeff, his mother, Kim, his brother, Derek, and his fiancée, Marissa Jones. It's my hope that the legislature will recognize and honor Andrew Keller for his outstanding service, for his work in the community, and for his sacrifice. I think what summarizes my feelings about him came from a young man who told Andrew's father at the funeral that of all of the kids that I went through in high school, Andrew was the only one that was always nice to me. And I have heard many stories like that about him. He was an exceptional young man, and I think this is a very appropriate honor for him and his family.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed, also from Beaverton. Senator Haas has done a good job summarizing a lot of the story of Andrew Keller, so I don't have a lot of specifics to add, but it's not the first time we've encountered the Kellers. During my freshman session, we were able to honor the Keller family for their role in the Murray Hill Little League team that made it to the Little League World Series, and I got to meet the rest of his family when they were here. And so we've kept in touch to a certain extent, and Senator Haas and I were able to attend the Southridge football game this fall, where they retired Andrew's jersey or his number, and he is enough of an impact in the Beaverton community that the Beaverton School District is engaged in a really tough debate about their policy with respect to naming stadiums and other facilities. Enough people in the Beaverton community are interested in renaming the Southridge Stadium in his honor. Not an easy decision, but I think that's an indication of how much of an impact he had and how much people want to find an appropriate way to honor him. I too think this is a very appropriate way to honor him, and the Senator and I were talking a little bit about what we might say here, and I think it's also telling that we both independently, without coordinating, had the idea of closing with that same statement about Andrew's friend. I've picked it up in a column that was in the Oregonian. The line from John Canzano's column was, a classmate who was picked on in high school called Jeff, Andrew's father, after hearing the news and said, sir, I want you to know your son was nice to me when nobody else was. I think that's a good summary of who he was, and appreciate your support of this memorial.
And we appreciate you bringing it forward. Madam Vice Chair? Senator Olson?
No, thank you.
I would point out it's, and I appreciate both of you attending the services for this young man. I've gone to a lot of the services, but having been the officer that sent, you know, far too many who didn't come home, I generally have a challenge at services. And it is, I suppose, an ironic situation that, you know, I'm the officer who certified the combat jump for his battalion that was in Iraq and with the 173rd. But I appreciate you bringing this forward.
Thanks, sir.
Is there anybody? I don't think there's anybody else signed up, right? It'll be our intent to move it to a work session next week. For those of you, I guess, the first time you guys have been before our committee, we only do public hearings 1 week, and then we do work sessions the next week. Unfortunately, many of our aging veterans that are out there don't see things that happen until they're already up on our internet, so we try to give them a week to respond and put input into the files. Other than that, this is one that we would move immediately, but as I say, it's generally our SOP, our standard operating procedure from the military, to wait a week so everybody can put input into the records. But again, I do appreciate you bringing it forward, and I appreciate the pictures and stuff. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR. SCR 9. And again, I appreciate it from coming. And we have two more bills that are on, and then we're going to go to a public hearing of that. And the first one is SB 35, and we'll open a public hearing on that. Madam Counsel and Mr. Mann, I see you're on the list.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 35 modifies the limit on the dollar amount of home and farm loans made by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Mann with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Another loan bill. I think I ought to give some context to what we're doing with these two loan bills. Back in the 80s, we had 114,000 loans. We were the largest lender in the state. Our portfolio was $3.5 billion. When the loan program got into some trouble, that was a whole lot of money that was tied up in bonding. So the program actually closed for 3 years. In those days, we had 600 employees with our agency. We had 14 field offices. We were a big group. When they reopened the program after 3 years of it being closed, the program never again achieved the level of loans per year that we had previously. The year before we closed, we had, I think, done 865 loans. When we opened it 3 years later, we were in the 400 range. And we dwindled, and we dwindled, and we dwindled. In the meantime, all those World War II veterans, Korean vets, and the Vietnam veterans started paying off their loans. And given that we could not do refi, given the kind of bonding we have, people would refi outside of our program. So we've gone from 114,000 loans and a $3.5 billion portfolio to 2,000 loans and about $200 million portfolio. So the drain on the state is very, very different. Now, I think the agency recognizes what it did 25 years ago and has not done it since. On the other hand, the world has changed since this loan program came to be in 1945. And we recognize that if the agency is going to be solvent, we need to make loans. Our agency budget is dependent upon the loan department being successful. About $16 million of biennium is spent in loan money to fund the agency. We're not a general fund agency. We get about $8 million, roughly, general fund, about half of which is passed through to the counties. So our agency is absolutely dependent upon the loan program being functional. So we came forward with a couple bills to try to enhance the product. The first one was, as we talked in Senate Bill 34, to expand what we can do. This bill is unique because what it allows us to do is do federal VA loan guarantee loans. Currently under statute, our loan-to-value ratio, meaning how much money we can loan, is 100%. You could get 100% loan, zero down, 100% loan from us under statute. VA guaranteed loans are unique, however. VA doesn't lend the money, it guarantees it like a mortgage broker. But to do so, they let you loan at 103%, and they take that extra 3% and use it as mortgage insurance, basically. So under statute, we can't do federal USDVA loan guarantee loans because we only do the 100% level. We've talked as an agency as to whether we want to get into USDVA loan guarantee loans. There are pros and cons to it. I can tell you, listening to my underwriter every day send loans to the federal VA, however, that I lose a ton of business every day because the federal VA loan is a better loan than ours. And a lot of those folks coming back from these current conflicts don't have the 20% down, don't have the 5% down, don't have the credit to get into a 0% down in our loan. And we send them to VA because they can get into a federal guaranteed VA loan. We are losing a lot. So I've told my loan manager, look, we got to do something to stop the bleeding. We got to stop sending people away because our portfolio is dying and we need to beef it up. And this is just simple business. And so we've talked internally, what would be the first thing we'd need to do in order to explore this idea of doing federally guaranteed loans? And that way we would be able to say, we do VA loans, and we would do every VA loan, not just the states, but also this guarantee. The first thing we'd have to do in statute is change it from 100% LTV, loan to value, to 100, and I believe it's 3%, I don't have the bill in front of me, to increase that so we would have the capacity to meet the federal standards for the federal VA, so that extra percentage on top of the 100 would work as the guarantee part, should a loan default, and VA guarantee to the lender that payment. So Senate Bill 35 asks basically for that permission to do that. I know that we've talked to the legislature about this before, and there's been some questions whether the legislature supports policy-wise ODVA doing federal VA loans, and I believe this is the opening of that discussion. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Question, because the bill is basically matches the federal language, which is 103, but so being a simple, stupid infantry officer, you need to go back to beginning. So the reason you do 103 is so that you do 100% loan, and then 3% is used to buy mortgage insurance.
Actually, Mr. Chair, the 3% is the VA's part that does their guarantee. You don't have to have that mortgage insurance piece, but it's the VA guarantee that's just like mortgage insurance.
Keep shoveling. Let the expert talk here. I think what I'm trying to figure out is how do we guarantee the loan, what is the 3% for, and please identify yourself.
Chair Boquist, for the record, my name is Steve Schlagen, the loan program manager for the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs. The bill presented, the increase in the loan-to-value would reflect 103.3%. 3.3% is the ceiling of the funding fee, which the federal VA loan program has. It could be as high as 3.3%. And that's the reason for the increase from where we currently sit at 100%. Currently, for us, because loans that are greater than 80% require private mortgage insurance, while statutorily we have the authority to do 100% lending, there is not an MI carrier in the nation that will allow anything greater than 97. So we're requiring a 3% down payment minimum and certain credit scores. The issues surrounding this product would enhance the program tremendously. Yes, it is fraught with some other issues. Delinquencies, as I pointed out earlier, delinquencies in the federal program is high. And not all of the insurance, as is private mortgage insurance, not all the insurance portion of the federal VA loan would cover all the losses that you could obtain and realize from this product. However, it is another product. It's another program that we could offer to enhance this program and make us more profitable and being available to spread the type of programs that are out there to our veterans.
Advisor?
Again, it would be nice to, in your conversations with the Treasurer's Office, bring this bill up too. Because I am very ignorant on the on this issue and how it the ramifications of it on our budget and on your budget.
Right. Senator?
Yeah, absolutely. Could you walk us through the process if a vet comes into you and he wants to get a loan, what he has to do to get it?
Sure. Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, fundamentally when an applicant comes in, we sit down and we'll chat with them and fundamentally find out at that point in time what is it they're looking for, how much money they have for a down payment, are they looking for 100% loan, where their credit lies, what is their financial position, and that's kind of a, in a general, very basic basic format in which we chat. If we find that we are unable to transact anything at that point in time based upon their financial position, in other words, in fact, yesterday I talked with two individuals that came in to chat about a loan product. Both cases, they had very little money, but their credit was good, and I ended up having to send them off to some of our third-party originator base. The basis of the interview is just to determine some real cursory information as to where they are and where I need to send them.
Follow up?
Please.
Okay, you've determined that they're approved, that they can meet your requirements. What's their next step? Do you actually do the paper, write the paper, and finance them, or do you send them out to the market and then repurchase the loan?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, we actually will refer them out to our third-party originator base. We do not have internal loan officer staff to accept applications in the agency. So we will give them a more than two referrals to third-party originators that we have available that have been proven to be extremely loyal to our program, many of which, by the way, employ veterans or they have spouses that are veterans. And they're very, very loyal to us. We do a great deal of business with them. We do both brokers, mortgage brokers, and correspondent lenders. Correspondent lenders in this particular case are classified as who we have available right now, such as Wells Fargo, Bank of America, my old employer Sterling Bank, Umpqua Bank, Siusla Bank, just to name a few. But we will actually in turn send them to those entities to transact the application.
Oh, please, if you don't mind. What fees do they incur then by going to this third party? Do they pay fees to them and then pay fees back to your loan department?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, the fees that they pay at the brokerage or at the correspondent lender level would be identically the same fees as we would charge if they came to us and we were able to do something on a direct basis. The fees that we currently operate under, we can charge up to, at this point in time, 1 3/8 of a percentage point as an origination fee and a $495 processing fee for a broker, or we call it a documentation fee for a correspondent lender. Those are the only costs from a fee-based perception and condition that they're going to be allocated.
One follow-up, if you don't mind. So there's no fee charged from that third party that the veteran has to pay to get this loan processed. And what I'm getting at, does this third party originate the loan and give them the money, or allow them to have this money and then you step in and purchase this loan back from this third party? Is that how that works?
Chair Boquist and Senator Olson, on both the mortgage broker side and the, I'll address them on the mortgage broker side first. The applications come to us and we underwrite the loan. We also, at that point in time, when the loan is approved, when it goes to closing at a title company office, we then fund the loan.
Okay.
From a correspondent lender perspective, what occurs there is the correspondent lender is the funder. They will fund that loan. It was closed with that lender. They will in turn endorse the note and the deed of trust and other documentation that we have back to us, and then we will pay that correspondent lender whatever that purchasing price would be at that point in time.
Just being ignorant, and I don't speak Greek, and Senator Olson has now dug a fine enough hole that he's going to get to do some of this. What you're saying is you're the beneficiary, right? Is that how that?
Chair Boquist, that is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. We are the beneficiary.
Okay.
Yeah. We portfolio all of our loans. We're the lender, we are the funder, we are the originator in most of those transactions.
Mr. Chair, can I ask another question then?
Please, because you're going to be intimately involved in this.
What's the benefit to those third parties, Sterling Bank, Umpqua Bank, Wells Fargo, Bank of America? What's the benefit to them to get involved in the middle of this, to do have to do all the paperwork and all the background checks and the credit checks and all that stuff? What do they get out of it, and why do they want to waste their time doing it when they can put it in their own system?
Chair Boquist and Senator Olson, that's a great question, and oftentimes as a former banker, I kind of wonder the same thing. Why do you do it? For the most part, we have a very loyal base, and they are loyal to us. We pay fees of certain percentages to both of those entities. For example, our mortgage brokers, we will pay a fee of 1.6% of the loan amount plus that $495 fee. Lenders, we pay lenders 2% of the loan amount plus the $495 fee. Why the difference? Since the lenders have underwritten and have gone through all of those exercises to transact that loan, they have taken the liability and the risk upon themselves. Should they make a fatal error, we will go back and we will ask them to pay us off, which I have done on a number of occasions. And sadly to say, they've all been with Wells Fargo. But that's the difference between the two. It is a monetarily income-driven monster.
That's clean and simple.
Yeah, right. I don't speak Greek. I'm vice chair.
I don't either, by the way. But who would audit? I mean, you're the Department of Veterans Affairs, and you're having a third party private. Right, they're not under you. And so when we have, does the state audit you and still be able to audit whatever with the third party originator person?
Chair Boquist and Senator, we do have auditors that come in and audit the program. Marina and Company, which is a CPA firm out of Portland, audits random selection of our loans and our transactions. Supplement to that is that I audit the lender loans that come in once we purchase. The issues surrounding those audits from Marina and Company, as an example, I am very close to them when we go through those audits, going and helping them recognize and looking for certain issues and what parameters that they need to look for. They become an instrumental entity for us. And by the way, just to toot my own horn, if I allow me to do that, in my almost 6.5 years as the program manager at Veterans Department, our audits have all passed with flying colors. We receive, if we were going to rate them, I'd rate them AAA. It's having, again, a former banker as I've been in all those years, that's one of the things that I take very, very dear to heart is quality of the loans that we purchase.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. So the state doesn't get involved. The state auditing people don't get involved with the military fair.
Chair Boquist, Senator Anderson. Yes, the state treasury does come in and look at certain situations and conditions in the program, but to be a little more detail oriented, the firm of Marina Company does, in my estimation, a little more detailed view of an audit of those files. So yes, you do have the oversight and the overview of a couple different entities, and then incorporate into that the internal format that we employ.
Well, where I'm going with this is. The mess we got into in the 80s, I mean, were the same audit pieces in place way back then? I mean, the fact that it just got out of hand. I'm just looking at transparency, and I'm looking at accountability.
Chair Boquist and Senator Anderson, I was not there in the 80s. I was 19 at the time. No. So I don't know of all the parameters that were there, and don't know under what circumstances the audits were maintained. All I can share with this committee is under my watch what is currently being done and what I've additionally implemented to the program.
Looks like someone else is coming up.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, this is Aaron Hunter, who for a long time was our internal auditor, and he is now our comptroller. He looks like the master of all history, so we're going to let him.
Chair Boquist and Senator Anderson, I was not there in the 80s, obviously.
State your name for the record.
My name is Aaron Hunter. I'm the financial controller of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Going to your question as far as does the state audit the loan program, the answer is yes. The Secretary of State Audits Division is the auditor of public accounts, and they come on an annual basis. And since Mr. Schlag has been here, they have actually contracted out that audit to Marine and Company, but the Secretary of State is the ultimate one responsible for it and then audits their work papers. Mr. Schlag was also talking about the quality control function that the loan program does. As far as the internal audit that was done there, and while I was there, I also performed a internal audit that looked at the controls and the quality of the loan files, and they did come out clean. Going back to the 80s, I think you were talking about, we did institute many more controls since then. I work for the CFO, who was there during that period of time, and he has relayed many changes within the program to me. One of the key ones that we look at on an annual basis is there is a annual cash flow analysis that's performed, where we bring in actually some really, really certified smart people that take a look at where we are at within our fiscal position, our cash position, the number of loans we have, the prepayment schedules, and actually go out 30, 40 years kind of looking at where we are cash flow-wise going out. So we do not, it is never our intention to get back to that position that we were in the 80s.
Thank you.
Okay. I think what we're going to do is Senator Olson's going to head up a work group on SB 34 and 35. I will join him because I don't even speak Greek, and he obviously has something of what's going on. Council, I would like to have both LFO and LRO look at both of these bills in terms of the policy position, and please ask both of them to dust off their gray hair and look back to what transpired behind us. And I would like the State Treasurer's Office to have a representative, if they'd be kind enough to join that work group, so that we can change Greek to English and then make a policy decision of whether we want to go or not go.
Mr. Olson. Are we going to do, am I going to head up the work group on 34-35 combination?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think the two are really one and the same. I think they're, even though they're separate bills, they are the same issue. And I will join you with that. I'm sure Senator Courtney would be happy to volunteer his staff member to join in that, because she could then go back and get history of what happened when none of us were here before. And being that we are a nonpartisan committee, we'll at least look at this before we make a decision. Does that sound good enough to you?
Roger that.
Okay, that's perfectly fine.
And Mr. Chair, you didn't ask that question this way.
There was a reason, I think.
You are the junior member, as
absolutely.
You did.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
So you don't have a lot of choice with this particular director.
You know, the magnitude of this is, I could be wrong. Gosh, I wish I could. I think, even had to go into special session over this issue. I think that was a situation. So, I just remember it was significant. You already heard him use some major. And you know, the state's full faith and credit had to back this thing, and so we were struggling. I thought we were going to impose a statewide property tax on to get this thing funded, possibly. So
I believe you're correct. I now remember some of this history.
I'm not trying to, you know, say we shouldn't. I'm just saying it was significant, and maybe everything's fine now. You say everything's fine, but I'll tell you, I think there's a history there, and we were in dire straits. But I'm not trying to be melodramatic, and I didn't mean to give you a hard time. Just ask.
I did.
Okay. It's difficult to lose 2% in interest rate spread in volume, and that is no longer the case. So.
Well, I think it's a perfect opportunity for the new director to get relieved and fired within the first week when it goes bad. So that's what happens to Marine captains. With that, I'm going to close the the public hearing on SB 35, and we're going to, don't go anywhere, gentlemen. I'm going to open the last public hearing we have, which is on SB 36. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 36 makes express that disbursements from the Veterans Educational Aid account are subject to available funds.
Hopefully, Mr. Mann, this is a little bit easier.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Mann with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. We're going to talk a little bit about our educational aid program, a program started in 1944. This program is a unique program for education for veterans. If you don't have a federal education benefit, GI Bill, vocational rehabilitation from the VA, something like this, our little program would provide you a monthly stipend. If you're a full-time student, you get $150 a month. If you're a part-time student, you get $100 a month. It's a pretty simple program. Everything was going swimmingly with about $90,000 a biennium of funding. 2008, the economy crashed, and there was a run on the program. Veterans were being laid off. They were finding they needed to go back to school and retool to become marketable. And what we found when we looked at this statute, because we hadn't really looked at it, it says that veterans shall have the right and privilege of state financial aid. It's a mandate. We had to fund it. So as hundreds of veterans came forward, we went to the emergency board and asked for more money. And the program grew from about $90,000 to nearly $400,000. And the LFO grabbed me by the arm and said, what are you going to do about this? And I smiled and I said, I don't know if I can do anything about it because the statute has this as a entitlement program. So we would run out of money. What would happen is we would get our disbursements from eBoard as much as we could get, and we had everybody in the program, and they would get about a quarter and a half or two quarters into their program, and the money would run out, and everyone would then lose their benefit. We thought that's just not the right way to kind of do this program. When someone signs up in September for educational aid, their expectation is while they're in school through June, they're going to get paid their money. And so we come forward with Senate Bill 36 that would change the shall to may and make it dependent on the finances. In the governor's balanced budget, the program goes back to its historical levels of about $86,000. We've noticed that since the 2008 run, I just asked my manager on this yesterday, we're close to that now with the amount of students we have in the program. It's ramped down. A lot of folks have found work, and they're not getting into this program as much. But I'm concerned, and the agency was concerned, that this was an entitlement, that one that we could not financially meet. And so we would ask that it be more of a benefit based upon how much money is available in the budget to actually fund that program, with the understanding that there was that one-time run. It was very painful. We had veterans that we had to tell no, right in the middle of your school, I'm sorry, you're not going to get your $150 a month. Now, I'll be honest with you, that doesn't seem like much money. I remember going to college eating hot dogs and Top Ramen, and every nickel I had counted. And $150 a month could go far to pay for that textbook nowadays that costs that much from your professor, or buying your groceries for that month. And a lot of people depend on that. So we're hoping that two things happen, that we can pass this bill to make it a may instead of shall kind of program, and then two, that the monies we have are going to situate with the number of veterans we have using the program at this time.
So what I think I hear you saying is what it would be is, when you redo the administrative rules, that if they signed up in September with anticipation of going through that term, like a term by term or whatever it is, then you would, for better word, fence that funds in there. They would get that benefit for that school year, if that's the school year they're approved for, and then you would take first come applications until we, the legislature, told you were out of money, which is basically what we do when we give you your appropriation.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly what we've been doing. Is we had an active list of people that signed up and were in school, and then we had a pending list. And so if someone would drop out of school, because that happens where they would graduate, we would move the next person in. And so that's exactly how we did it.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, you had a question?
Yes, thank you. So when you have your budget, and I know slowly we're improving, but it's still pretty, we still have to be making cuts, unfortunately. But how do you prioritize? I mean, do you have an advisory committee that says that helps? I mean, this is something where it would be easy for admin to say, no, we got to put it here or there, and we lose the sight of the real need of the veteran. I was just wondering, how do you prioritize your
Mr. Chairman and Vice Chair, we do have an advisory committee. We have a legislative subcommittee on that advisory committee. We also get together as an executive staff, and we look at our general fund allocations. As I said earlier, our general fund allocations is relatively small compared to the rest of the agency. So we have three or four major programs. We have the county veteran service officers. We have our state veteran service officers. Those are the tip of the spear people providing those benefits, and we don't like to touch that because that's kind of core mission. We have the emergency grant program, which provides a one-time grant for people for gap funding. If a veteran needs a truck repair because they can't get to work, and if they don't get to work, they're not going to get paid. If they don't get paid, they can't pay their rent. We fix the truck. We have the educational aid program, which is a legacy program. It's been around for 60-plus years. And then we have some money that goes to national service officers to make sure that the VFW and those can also do tip-of-the-spear claims work. But then we have our conservatorship program, and that program is when a veteran is deemed incompetent by a court of the VA and cannot manage their own funds, we help manage those funds. That's where our general fund monies go. And so when we prioritize, we definitely prioritize based upon which program. And the first program are those county veteran service officers, and our service officers that provide the tip of the spear, and then we prioritize from there.
Thank you.
Sir Olson, question?
I probably would imagine that this is going to be in my work group, too, so I'll just tell them.
But you will be relieved to know that it's not, but I had thought about that right off the bat. But since being a smart infantry officer and I figured out finally what he was saying, I decided that, you know, we can deal with that one in a different way. Senator Courtney, question?
No, I do not.
We'll take it under consideration.
Thank you, Mr.
I think there's a few hurdles like March 4th that we need to go over in a few places like that, and then we'll come back and discuss this one at a later time.
But
sure, we will discuss it.
Roger that.
Thank you.
It was a military term, wasn't it, sir? Roger that.
Roger that. That's right. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 36, and then we're going to move to informational hearings. How many witnesses are on this one? I think what we're going to do first is we're going to open an informational meeting on veterans housing issues. If you call, you folks would come down. I see Ryan. Ryan, you know who the four of you are. If you'll just move everybody down here. And then we're just going to open an informational meeting. I'm going to step out just momentarily, if you don't mind, Madam Vice Chair, so I can use the restroom.
We didn't really need to know that.
Who goes first?
I will go first. Chair Montes Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Housing Authorities, the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, and the Housing Alliance. I'm here today to kick off a short conversation about housing and veterans. And I would like to start, if I could, with a few images on a PowerPoint projection that we have here. I'll wait for the committee administrator to, she says there's a magic button that will put this up on the screen.
Now we just have to hook the yellow sticky.
Yes, here we go. So all of us need a safe place to call home in order to be successful in life. And I'd like to start by showing you what we as a state are capable of. This is Gray's Landing that just opened on the South Waterfront in Portland. This is the Vet Lift Program in St. Vincent de Paul of Lane County. And what these two projects have in common is they both do something that we know works. They connect housing and services, and they help veterans lead more successful lives. And these are veterans like John, who I had the opportunity to meet this year, who drove from the Vet Lift program in Eugene to come down to Salem to testify in the House Veterans Affairs Committee. He told his story to that committee, and after serving in Desert Storm, he came back suffering from PTSD and addictions, and eventually became homeless. Now, after his time with this Vet Lift program, he's finishing his undergraduate degree, he's enrolled in graduate school next fall, and he's on the path toward owning his own home. And this is an example of how, with the right resources, our communities and our state can rise to the occasion and honor a commitment that we have to those who have served our country, and we can solve problems. in this case, the problem is that 18 to 30-year-olds who have served in the military are twice as likely to be homeless as those who have not served. The stress and trauma of active duty can have long-lasting impacts on the veterans, on their families, and on our communities. And, you know, as people, when we don't have the basics, when we don't have food, shelter, warmth, we go into fight or flight mode. And we're not meeting our potential at that time, we're just surviving. Our communities lose out on that potential. We lose leadership, we lose entrepreneurs, we lose teachers. But the good news is that we know how to make a difference. We can use proven methods that connect housing to critical services like healthcare, mental health and addictions treatment, job training, so that veterans can earn and build assets and lead better lives. There's also more good news. Right now, we have an opportunity. The VA and HUD are dedicating resources to address this crisis, and we have an opportunity to make the most of these resources. With a relatively small investment sustained by the state, we can leverage federal dollars to help veterans in our communities overcome barriers and reach their potential. There's a bill in the House Bill 2417, that has bipartisan sponsorship and just moved unanimously out of the Veterans Affairs Committee. It creates a stable, ongoing funding source so that we can address housing barriers across the state. And when I talk about the housing continuum, I'm talking about from homelessness to home ownership and that stable housing that that is in between. What this bill does is it creates a funding source by increasing a filing fee on real property transfers, like when you buy a home, by $5. Those $5 will go toward helping veterans find a safe, stable home, and it would raise close to $6 million in the 13-15 biennium and close to $9 million the following biennium. These resources will flow to communities throughout the state and help those communities meet the local needs that veterans are facing. It will allow community-based organizations to partner with the VA and better leverage those federal investments. By stepping up now, we can serve our communities, we can activate the leadership, the entrepreneurship, the skills that veterans possess, we can honor the commitment that we have and that we all share to those who have served, and we can help ensure that Oregonians have a safe place to call home. That concludes my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions, and there are some other folks here who have more on-the-ground experience.
I have a question regarding, you know, we just passed an initiative by the voters that we could not have any transfer fees. And the recording fee is not a transfer fee, correct?
Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson, thank you for the question. Yes, we have worked with Legislative Council to make sure that this proposal is in line with the ballot measure that passed. That was ballot measure 79. This is expanding an existing recording fee, and that is clearly within the allowances of that.
And it's strictly for veterans housing rather than affordable housing.
Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson, that is correct. It expands it by $5, and all of that $5 would be dedicated solely for veterans.
And what is the need for veterans? I know the importance, but we have such a great need in the state for affordable housing, at least in my district. And I'm just wondering how when you say $5 recording fee, that's on every house purchase, and how much money is that going to draw in, and therefore how much money are we going to have?
Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson, in the 13-15 biennium, from the activation date until the end of the biennium, it would be about three quarters of that biennium, and at current recording rates, the estimates are that it would raise just under $6 million in that 13-15 biennium. In the 15-17 biennium, where we have the full time period where that would be collected, the estimates are that it would be closer to $9 million.
There are going to be some nonprofits to say, why didn't we think of this? But then we also, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson, nonprofits housing authorities, community action agencies would all have an opportunity to utilize these funds to serve veterans to meet their needs in their communities through the systems that are already in place that get these dollars to the local resource, to the local agencies.
Madam Vice Chair, you're doing a fine job.
No, I think I'll turn it over to you now. And we've only heard one testify, so.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Rachel Post. I am a licensed clinical social worker and a public policy advisor at Central City Concern in Portland, Oregon. Central City Concern provides comprehensive, coordinated care through integrated health care, supported affordable housing, peer relationships, and legitimate acquisition of income to about 13,000 people a year in Portland. Many of those people are coming from all parts of Oregon. We serve at any given time 800 individuals who are veterans experiencing homelessness. While we do receive some federal funding through the Department of Labor and the Department of Veterans Affairs for our programming to provide some employment assistance and some transitional housing, we in no way are able to meet the needs of all 800 individuals who are exiting homelessness. I believe the national estimate, Senator Mona Sanderson, is about somewhere between 23% of those experiencing homelessness are veterans. We know that having a safe, stable place to call home is the first step for people to move forward in their lives. And as you can imagine, as you've heard before, people with mental health disorders, physical disabilities, substance use issues need a safe place to call home to make progress and remove the barriers so they can move on with their lives. Of course, veterans have additional obstacles. They often experience post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injuries, and military sexual trauma. It's a sad truth. Supported housing is innovative and proven solution to some of the community's toughest problems. It combines affordable housing with services that help people who face the most complex challenges to live with stability, autonomy, and dignity. Supportive housing improves housing stability, employment, mental health, physical health, school attendance, reduces active substance use, and it's documented in over 50 empirical research studies to reduce the cost of psychiatric and medical hospitalization, emergency room visits by as much as 50%. I'd like to end with this quote from the U.S. Army Ranger Creed, which states, "I'll never leave a fallen comrade to fall into the hands of enemies." Homelessness, unemployment, and poverty are the enemies of our returning veterans. Please support House Bill 2417 so that we can do better at ending and preventing these social ills. Thank you.
Chairman Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gerald Puggett, and I'm a veteran who has served this country. And today, I still serve our veterans in following up with this quote. My job that I've been doing for the last 15 years has been in the trenches, finding these veterans, helping them meet their psychological needs, their PTSD needs, and a wide variety of other barriers that get in their way. One of the greatest obstacles that I experience with veterans that I've been doing this for 15 years is if their basic needs aren't met, they're not willing to do anything else because they're more concerned about, where am I going to sleep tonight? Do I sleep in the arch of the mission again? Do I sleep under a tree in the park? Do I get harassed by the police? There's a lot of excuses that go on with how they deal with this concern. On the more positive side, over the last 15 years, every time that we get a veteran stabilized, then great things start to happen. Once that security need is met, I recall a veteran that I worked with in 1993. He had PTSD. He was back from Vietnam. He couldn't interact with society. We were fortunate enough to get our hands on him, worked with him, because I do mental health counseling through Northwest Human Services. And within 3 years, he started his own business right here in Salem, and within 10 years, had employees of 13. Owned his own home, now he's retired, and he's helping other veterans. And by passing this bill, us nonprofits that are in the trenches can get the job done. Thank you.
Senator Vice Chair, Senator Olson, question?
Yes, anyone can answer this one. It's a $5 increase, and according to this bill, 25% must go to the Housing and Community Service Department. What kind of dollars are we talking about?
Senator Boquist, Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, those would be the dollars that I referred to. And the reason that 25% number is in there is because we are expanding an existing fee. So the current fee is $15, and we're expanding it by $5. And we're saying that all of those $5 needs to go to veterans. And so 25% of the $20.
No, I understand all of that. That
sure.
Part is easy. What's the bottom line? How much will you raise?
Oh, thank you. Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson, that would be the close to $6 million in the first biennium, where it would be collected during three quarters of that time. And then in the next biennium, when we collect it over the full 2 years, it would be about $9 million, according to current recording estimates.
That's a lot of transactions. So is everything included? Housing, real estate, commercial, anything that's transacted is...
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, it is real property transfers, and I'd be happy to come by. I've got some more detailed information I could give you about that.
Okay, thank you.
There's three of you. Was there four people signed up? There were four people.
Mr. Mann.
Mr. Mann is. Are you available, or are you here?
Certainly.
Okay. And colleagues, what we're looking for is some individual feedback so that we can give our comrades on the other side of the chamber some guidance of what we're thinking or what we would think. This is called efficiency in government rather than do things that don't move. So if you can think about it, if they would follow up with you and then kind of get your thoughts back to me, and then I will convey them to the chair on the far side. You have...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Mann with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. The only thing I'd like to add is, in Oregon, it's very tough to count how many veterans are homeless. They do one-night homeless counts, and they come up with 2,500. We've done counts and come up with 7,000. We just don't know how many there are. And they don't always come in, and they don't always say they're veterans, and people claim they're veterans who aren't veterans. So it's a very tricky business. I read in Stars and Stripes 2 days ago that under sequestration, one of the things that might get hit are the homeless programs at the VA, including the HUD-VASH voucher. Currently, if you go anywhere in your districts, you will hear them say there's not enough vouchers. A lot of the vouchers in Eastern Oregon are regulated by the VAs in Boise and Walla Walla. So Eastern Oregon's not getting its share out of these other two states. The question is, if sequestration happens, how many vouchers where we don't have enough do we lose out of these VA hospitals, and what is that going to mean to getting permanent housing for veterans? And so as we grapple with this, the tip of the spear is you have that veteran across from your desk and he's homeless. Or I get the call from the homeless veterans living in his truck in the Wilsonville rest station. He's been doing so for 3 years. What do I do with that person? And the reality is, at the tip of the spear, it's very difficult right now to do anything with that person other than try to get them some VA health care and start the benefits process, because there is just more demand than there is supply. And so from a policy perspective for our agency, we're grappling with, just when they come to our office and we get our hands on them, if we can't help them then, we don't know if we can get our hands on them again. And so the homeless veteran issue is a very real issue from our perspective.
And Vice Chair?
There's a huge need. And if we are wanting to serve our veterans in the manner that they deserve, we should pass this. I have no question. You know the politics. There are some people in this legislature that have said no way are they going to vote for a fee increase, a tax increase, etc. How sad. With that, I have to relay, my very, very first patient, when I went into the field, and you probably heard this story, was a
a veteran. I didn't know he was a veteran when I went to see him. And people were complaining about the smell that was coming from this little hovel that actually was just a few blocks from my house. And it turned out that he was a veteran. He had post-traumatic stress. He would go, I would see him often hobbling down the street, going into garbage cans to get his food. I mean, this was in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hmm. So it was very, very, had such a strong impact because we immediately, what maggots were growing in the sores on his lower legs. And it was so horrific. We got him into the ER. And thank God there was a very good veterans. The veterans just took over, and they got him into a home, and he's doing well. About 6 months later, I did a little follow-up. These situations, I think, are rampant everywhere, and that's why we so have to do something. So I feel that the politics of this is huge in trying to raise a tax. And if the legislature has the will, that's awesome. But, I know we want to send a message over, but you know the politics, and wouldn't this have to take a two-thirds vote? It would have to go out to the revenue committee? I don't know.
It comes from the House to us.
It wouldn't go through revenue?
Yeah, it's over in the House side right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, those are my two cents worth.
You or me first? Go ahead.
I would presume me because I'm the low guy in the totem pole.
You get to eat first in the chow line, too.
So do we know the exact number of homeless veterans? I mean, close approximation? We have no idea.
I believe we have no idea.
So to play the naysayer, the other side of this coin, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to ask for a 25% increase and a fee because it's $5 on a 15th, so you're going to go up to 20, you're going to go get 25% of that. But we don't know how many we have to give it to. So it's what I'm trying to do is make, you guys got to make this clear,
right,
that we need this $6 million and it has to, because I agree with you. We need to put these guys, we need to get them off the street. They're veterans. They need our help. But you got to make your message clear that we're going to ask for $6 million. And they're going to ask you the same question I ask you, how many? And you go, well, we don't know. So how do we know that $6 million is going to be spent efficiently and effectively?
Senator Boquist, Senator Olson, I first have to mea culpa as an agency. We don't take positions on bills. We're neutral on all of them. Where we come in is the difficulty of the federal VA telling us they're going to end homelessness in 5 years. A big push and everyone shining the light on homelessness. But I had a homeless Native American in my office at 8 a.m. one morning drunk. We tried to get him to the VA clinic. They wouldn't see him because he was drunk. We tried to get him to White City into the domiciliary, which he qualified for. But they said they couldn't see him unless he was referred by the clinic, who wouldn't see him because he was drunk. So we fed him all day and fed him coffee and kept him in our conference room and let him sleep it off. And at 4:45, we got him to the clinic. And no kidding, this happened. The provider saw him and let him go. Monday morning, this was a Friday, he ends up in my office again drunk. What happened? Well, they saw me and let me go. So we started reading the notes and I'm talking to these folks. And the note that they wrote was, this veteran needs to sober up or die.
Shameful.
We went to the VISN, which is the regional VA, and talked to them and said, that's not appropriate. What are we going to do? And they said, yeah, we have some gaps and we need to fix them. So we've been working really hard. The reality for us as an agency is, when I have a veteran in front of me, I really don't have an option to house them. I found out 3 days ago that veteran's in hospice is going to die. We lost him. And I'm frustrated and I'm upset about it. I can't talk about the money. That's not our issue. I can tell you this. There is a large homeless veteran population in this state. We've all talked for the past several years since the task force is that something needs to be addressed with the homeless veteran population. What that looks like, I don't know. I do know this. The federal VA is limited in its HUD-VASH vouchers. We are limited outside the I-5 corridor in infrastructure for homeless veterans. So if you're in Ontario and you have a suicidal veteran that's homeless, that person's going to jail because that's the only safe place for them. So we can talk about the realities of what we live as veteran service officers trying to advocate. The money part, again, I can't address that. I can tell you, though, that the systems are not in place currently to really manage the population. If you wanted my number, there are 7,000 homeless veterans in the state, but the one-night counts that the Department of Human Services does, along with the housing community folks, they come up with about 3,200. The task force we did in 2008 counted 7,000.
Follow-up?
Just remember, you're shooting at the wrong person, okay?
I know. I understand it. But I think the right person just walked in the door back there.
No. It's not the agency. I mean, this is not the agency.
Well, no,
the agency's only here for information.
I would just like to task someone to get these numbers.
Right.
Because it's important.
You're up.
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, I would be happy to be the one to take that task on.
Excellent.
Since you opened the can of worms, I mean, just
sure.
For the record, you're talking about sequestration. I believe the number that I saw is correct, and the number that you said in the federal VA and the vouchers is correct. We know that the 500-pound gorilla or the 800-pound gorilla in the federal budget is the Defense Department. We know in this committee, because we've heard it, that admirals said they can't put fleets to sea because they don't have money. We also know that it costs 30 cents on the dollar to keep a National Guard brigade versus an active duty brigade.
Mm-hmm.
We also know there's one huge amount of rhetoric going on in Washington, D.C., most of it total BS. Now, the federal VA, I think if the number I saw correctly, has about 500 legislative and government affairs officers across this nation. 500, the federal VA does. That's 500 public relations people in the federal VA. Those salaries alone would pay for a whole lot of vouchers. And I would hope that somebody in the federal side of the government stops doing the bloody rhetoric about what they're going to cut here and who they're going to scare there and we're going to cut this fireman and this policeman and pay attention to the vouchers, because they don't need 500 public affairs officers, because the reason they need 500 is because they don't have decent public affairs. They only need one or two if they had decent. But I understand your frustration, and the term is, but once again, I mean, you have the federal VA sending out their latest threat notes that, you know, if somebody doesn't give us more money, that we're going to cut X, Y, and Z. And so there's plenty of places that they could cut elsewhere, and you're right. But the problem we have at the state is pretty simple. They don't do it. They're on our streets. They're not in Washington, D.C., and so we have the problem. It's very easy for this building to turn around and say, well, it's a federal problem, but it's not a federal problem because they're in downtown Salem and they're in Troutdale and they're out in Canby and they're on our streets, and the feds, frankly, don't give a rat's rip in most cases. So, and I will apologize for Senator Olson, because I know you're the agency. It's not your bill. And we appreciate the ability to beat you up.
Always a pleasure.
Don't go anywhere, because you're next. And I appreciate your stuff. Madam Vice Chair?
Yeah, but Mr. Chair, I do think it's important for us to not always blame the higher-ups. And we're not going to see anything get done in Washington, D.C., as far as I'm concerned. But we can get something done here in the state of Oregon. And so here's an idea, and I would love to go with it. I would just love to see us see the suicide rate go down, see stable housing for our veterans. And, you know, we just have to be a pioneer in this. So be it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to close the informational hearing on veterans housing. And I see Cameron Smith is here. Once and future Marine Director of ODVA, and I would ask before we continue, Mr. Smith, how long is your brief?
I think we'll keep it brief.
Good. For that reason, then, I'm going to open an informational meeting on the policy impacts of ODA's budget.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, Senior Policy Advisor for Governor Kit Sauber on Military Veterans and Emergency Management, and honored and humbled to be his director nominee to take over for Director Jim Willis at Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs in an acting capacity March 1st, tomorrow, pending Senate confirmation from you all and your colleagues. And I'm hoping, I feel like I'm already getting fired before I'm getting confirmed. And I'm hoping not
Who
to
said
be,
you're going to get confirmed?
I am hoping not to be hageled, which is a new verb by the good chair and the members of the Senate. Much of what we discussed today earlier in relation to several of the veterans' home loan bills go to some of the core of what we are facing as a state agency in relation to our larger budget initiatives. So in the 11-13 budget, $6.54 general fund dollars flowing into the agency. Not much compared to what we get back in terms of that federal dollars flowing back of $1.9 billion of federal dollars in terms of compensation, pension, health care through the federal VA pension system. And of that general fund, much of that flows through the Department of Veterans Affairs down to the county level. So $3.49 million of general fund passed down to our partners at the counties who are doing that good tip of the spear work that Tom was talking about in terms of direct veteran services through the veteran service officers. And then the state plays that central role of certification and training. Where that leads us, the agency stood up after World War II in terms of that home loan program as the initial program. And we've been heavily, not just that one benefit for our veterans and their military families from the program itself, but that has been critical to the financing of the agency over the years. We can see why during the 80s there was so much concern, and it went to the heart not just of the agency's finances, but given the dynamics at the time, to the core of the state finances. We're in a much better place in terms of that individual program not being a risk to the larger state bonding and indebtedness capacity and at risk for our bonds failing. Good controls that we heard about on that front. But the Veterans Home Loan Program does have significant challenges and opportunities right now. We're not immune from the housing market issues that we saw beginning in 2008 and before. Loan originations have been way down. We need to get those back up to preserve the health of the Veterans Home Loan Program and to ensure we continue to be able to pay off those bonds going forward over the years. Dating back to the early 90s, there was for the recession at that time, we took some funding out of general fund for core veteran services and shifted that onto the Veterans Home Loan Program and its reserves. That had continued, so we've been more heavily reliant, subsidizing our core veteran services, not just on the general fund dollars that we are fortunate to get from the legislature, but also on our home loan program reserves. So in this governor's budget for 2013-2015, we were able to carve an extra $1.6 million of general fund requested through that budget to submit up to Ways and Means and the legislature, not for an increase of services, but to shift away from what we've been funding those core services that largely fall under Tom's shop in terms of the Veteran Services Division, making sure that we're not digging our own hole on the Veterans Home Loan Reserves Program, and making sure those core services are paid through the general fund. So you will see an increase of the general fund ask in the governor's budget, approximately $7.8 million. Again, not new services, and we've been preaching to the choir in terms of a lot of the demands from the aging Vietnam generation and the younger generation coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. I think there will be multiple considerations for increase in funding depending on all the different variables that factor out and priorities in the budget process. But that 1.6 fund shift is critical to the agency to not be our own worst enemy on our home loan reserves. And I think I'll end there. And I think we punt into the larger work with Senator Olson. We're happy to come back and give a larger brief on the structure and dynamics within the Veterans Home Loan Program, both due to competitive interest rates, just generally the housing market, the lack of ability to refinance. Some of the bills we've presented help structure the program long-term to make sure it's a self-sustaining program in and of it for itself, but because it's so critical to the whole entire agency's finances. So much of that, I think, we will punt into the work group, and happy to come back as things calm down during session if we can do a larger brief on the Veterans Home Loan Program. I'm happy to take any questions.
Madam Vice Chair? Senator Olson?
No. Cut you some slack. Until the hearing. Till confirmation.
Yeah, I will vote for you, okay? But I do think you have a big task.
Yeah.
A real big task, because the need is going to increase, the funding is going to be tight. And I think there's a couple of other, I'm slightly more optimistic than my vice chair on passage of certain things. And mind me, I'm the conservative Republican here, by the way. So as soon as I walk out of this room, I'll be broadsided again. But having said that, I think there are some areas out there that we will see some improvements in.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, we've been talking about the window closing in terms of as operations overseas wind down, attention dwindles onto the veterans and military affairs right when we need to be ramping up. So we're very open to that conversation with this committee and on the Ways and Means side.
And I appreciate that, and I look forward to you working with Senator Olson. Right, Senator Olson?
Absolutely, and I want to congratulate you on this step forward. I think it's going to be amazing for our veterans, and I think you'll be a great leader. Mm-hmm. At least I hope you will.
Thank you. Now, you did work for the Navy, right?
How the Marine Corps works.
I would point out, and for of course, the three of us are here laughing. No problem with that. But I would say that Jim Willis, his retirement ceremony, which three of us were here and attended, and of course the people that were non-veterans, that were the staff, and they were looking at us like, you guys all hate each other or something. And no, it's not. Most veterans understand that there's always a good ribbing. The reason the caissons go rolling along is the Army hasn't got anything better, right? And the reason the Air Force has this song is they used to be part of the Army Air Corps. And so the one thing about veterans is there's a lot of camaraderie, even in austere times.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I will save any comments on my fellow branches in the armed services until after the confirmation.
Smart move. With that, I'm going to close the public or the informational meeting on policy impacts of the budget. Madam Vice Chair, anything? Mm-hmm. Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Courtney? With that, the meeting for the day is over.
Let me get this. Is fee increased? Is fee fiscal?
I think it is. It's a House vote. They're trying to restructure the thing.
Only 4 years, it's a three-fifths vote.
I know it is. Yeah.
Mr. President.
How are you going to get back?
The recording is still on. Your committee's already.
Mr. President.